Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, February the 28th, 2018. We begin with the news section. Don't let it happen here. In the wake of the most recent school shooting, North Carolina lawmakers want to arm teachers. Students want to vote the SOBs out. Why does this keep happening, and what can be done to stop it? These questions elicit a familiar routine in the wake of mass shootings like the Valentine's Day slaughter of 17 students and teachers in Parkland, Florida. Gun control advocates decry the gun lobby and documents the NRA's contribution to Republican offerings, thoughts and prayers to the victims. Wayne LaPierre, the executive director of the NRA, serves platitudes about armed Americans stopping bad guys with guns and warns Second Amendment enthusiasts that the leftists are coming for their weapons. We watch the families of the deceased mourn, and we hear anguished survivors beg lawmakers for tougher gun laws. Each time people wonder if this time will be the mass shooting that sparks change, and each time, at least to date, those hopes have been dashed by inaction. Amid it all, North Carolinians have spent the last 2 weeks trying to make sense of the news. Some packed town halls while others absorb the updates quietly. Parents discuss school safety with their children, and lawmakers propose policy changes. Reactions to the shootings and suggestions for preventative measures ran the gamut. For some Republicans in the General Assembly, the conversation quickly turned to giving teachers guns. House Speaker Tim Moore, after announcing the formation of a school safety committee, floated the idea of arming teachers if school districts and police stations were on board. If that happens, North Carolina would join 18 states that already allow teachers to bring guns to school. While Moore didn't promise that the proposal would see daylight, other lawmakers have been blunter. Last week, Republican State Representative Larry Pittman, a firebrand from Concord, voiced his support for arming teachers and said he had already been in talks with a police officer about the possibilities. We have to get over this useless hysteria about guns and allow school personnel to have a chance to defend their lives and those of their students, he said. Many lives could have been saved that were lost because the police got there, before the police got there. It's a position for which the NRA has long advocated. In 2013, an NRA supported task force issued a report that recommended arming teachers. The proposal was met with stiff resistance from the American Federation of Teachers, whose president called it a cruel hoax that will fail to keep our children in schools safe. Kevin Neely, a local school social worker with a background in mental health, agrees. I don't want any of my colleagues to be able to carry a gun to school, he said. They're not trained. I've watched teachers escalate kids. They make it worse. They don't mean to, but were not trained. Neely, whose position was created in the mid-90s to address students' mental health needs, said that he believes the core of the school shooting epidemic is access to assault rifles, not unaddressed mental health issues. If we had more mental health professionals in the schools, we might be able to recognize the people in school shootings, he said. But he adds, you can't regulate mental health. The thing that kills people in all of these school shootings is assault rifles. Last week, as survivors of the Parkland school shooting watched in the gallery, the Florida State House rejected a ban on assault rifles. Shana Broders, a fifth-grade teacher in Wake County, is also unconvinced that arming teachers would help prevent a future Parkland tragedy. I can't personally see how bringing more guns into a school will solve this problem, she said. There are, of course, teachers, like in all professions, that are quick-tempered, possibly dealing with anger issues, emotional outbursts. Why would we want to arm them? And to have them near kids, I can't wrap my head around that. Neither, it seems, can Republican State School Superintendent Mark Johnson, who earlier this week came out against arming teachers, proposing instead to hire more police officers to patrol the schools. In recent years, the NRA Foundation has lavished North Carolina schools with money. According to a 2016 report, the foundation gave $458,785 in grants to North Carolina schools, police departments, gun clubs, and Boy Scout chapters in support, among other things, shooting programs for kids. One of last year's many grant recipients across the country was the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Army Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps. According to the Associated Press, the alleged Parkman shooter was a member of the school's junior ROTC program. The NRA's broad influence among lawmakers was the subject of a scathing student-led town hall last week at Raleigh's Pullen Memorial Baptist Church. There, North Carolina students and activists called on local lawmakers to enact stricter gun control laws and to wipe their hands clean of NRA funding. "I have a zero-tolerance policy on politicians that get money from the NRA," said Aram Wolf, a survivor of the Virginia Tech massacre of 2007, to thunderous applause. "I also believe that arming our teachers is possibly the stupidest idea I've ever heard." At the beginning of the event, U.S. Representative David Price, a local Democrat who has long pushed for the federal government to reverse its ban on studying gun violence, said it was incredible that the U.S. couldn't deal with the scourge that has plagued schools and communities. "Other countries have mental health challenges. Other countries have challenges with violence. But only in this country does this result in daily carnage on our streets." "What is the difference?" he asked. "The difference is the weapon, the easy access to weapons, particularly weapons of mass killing." Multiple speakers pointed to the gun of choice for Parkland suspect Nicholas Cruz, an AR-15 rifle, and called on Congress to reinstitute an assault weapons ban. In 1994, lawmakers passed such a law, but it expired in 2004. According to a Quinnipiac poll released last week, 67% of Americans support banning assault weapons, and 97% favor universal background checks. State Representative Cynthia Ball, a Wake Democrat, told the crowd she wished her colleagues in the General Assembly had your like mind. Ball asked them to keep an eye on HB 746, an omnibus gun bill that would allow North Carolinians to carry concealed handguns without a permit. The bill cleared the State House in June and has not received a vote in the Senate. "Put the pressure on to make sure that that bill does not come back to us in our short session," she said. High schoolers talked about their fear of going to school in a climate where mass shootings seemed increasingly common. "I don't want to die in my high school. I don't want to die in college. Tell these people behind me," said Keith Kuhlman, a high school senior, referring to Republican Senators Richard Burr, Tom Tillis, and Representative George Holding. "Tell them that you do not want me to die. Go register to vote. Let them know. Let them know that you do not deserve to die in a country where gun violence has become too extreme." Her speech was followed by cries of, "Throw them out." The fact that we are relying on teenage survivors of a mass shooting for a change instead of the politicians we voted in is unacceptable, added Amelia Cox, a freshman at Enloe High School. "Politicians need to make it harder for people to legally purchase military-grade weapons. They need to enforce stronger background checks. They need to stop taking million-dollar donations from the NRA. They need to stop praying and actually get up and do something before more lives are taken away." She continued, "There's absolutely no logical reason an ordinary citizen needs an AR-15. Trump and other politicians in D.C. might think I'm just a kid who is not capable of making a difference. But we'll see what they think about when I vote in 2021. Our next news article, opportunity knocking. A little notice section of President Trump's tax law could have big ramifications for Durham's struggling neighborhoods. Encouraging investment in distressed areas doesn't sound like the kind of thing that would be included in the rich people-friendly tax plan congressional Republicans cooked up last year. But on page 130 of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there it is. Subchapter Z creates an Opportunity Zone designation for low-income census tracts and lays out tax breaks for investing in them. In this way, Opportunity Zones aren't altogether surprising. They create yet another tax benefit for the wealthy. But proponents say that the program could unlock some $2 trillion in investment across the country. Durham officials want in. Preliminary talks are underway between city and county officials. The Durham Housing Authority, local universities, and the businesses community got together to determine which Durham census tracts would be best to put forth for an Opportunity Zone designation, a decision ultimately up to the governor's office. To qualify, a census tract must have a median family income at or below 80% of the area median income, just over $58,000 for Durham, or have a poverty rate of 20% or greater from 2011 to 2015. There are about 1,000 census tracts in North Carolina that meet these requirements, including 30 in Durham, as well as others that may qualify based on proximity to low-income tracts. States can designate up to a quarter of these eligible tracts, which means there are 252 spots for that up for grabs in North Carolina. Local stakeholders' recommendations are due on March 8th. Andrew Pettigrew, director of the city's Office of Economic and Worldwide Development, says they will likely consider Census Tract 10.02, the focus of a poverty reduction initiative launched by former Mayor Bill Bell, and tracks surrounding NC Central, which is in need of student housing. Fayetteville Place, a vacant 20-acre lot owned by the DHA, and McDougal Terrace, the city's largest public housing development, which is in a census tract with a 57% poverty rate. I believe the Opportunity Zone legislation might give Durham its next great best opportunity to assemble this new mix of capital, private, public, and philanthropy, to work on, for example, affordable housing. And I think you know we all need all three, Pettigrew said. The city and the county can't solve the affordable housing issues alone. Anyone can submit a census tract for the state's consideration. The NC Department of Commerce will then make recommendations to the governor's office, which must forward its picks to the U.S. Treasury Department by March 21st. The Treasury Department is expected to rubber stamp those nominations. The law provides tax incentives to invest unrealized capital gains, assets that have accrued value but haven't yet been sold, in a qualified opportunity fund, which in turn will be required to put at least 90% of its assets into Opportunity Zone properties. The Economic Innovation Group, which pushed the initiative, estimates that U.S. investors hold $2.2 trillion in unrealized gains. Investors can avoid paying taxes for up to 9 years on gains invested in opportunity funds. They may also pay lower taxes on those gains or see some gains permanently excluded from their taxable income if their investment is held in a fund for at least 10 years. It's unclear whether they can just park their money in the fund without putting it to work in the community. This concept isn't new. Similar initiatives known as enterprise zones and empowerment zones were in place in the 80s and 90s. Scholars have found these programs give breaks to projects that would have happened anyway or didn't generate sufficient economic growth while depleting state and local resources. Napoleon Wallace, North Carolina's Deputy Secretary of Commerce, says there is more capital eligible for this initiative and more opportunities to invest in it. The level of state around this is bigger than any type of investment we've seen before, he said. Rachel Royal Carroll, Associate Director of the Impact Invest in Enterprise Community Loan Fund, says the best candidates for Opportunity Zone designation will be at the nexus of need and opportunity. Pettigrew thinks Durham fits that bill and has the political will to make the most of opportunity funds. One of the strengths, I think, of Durham applying for this is though we have a need, particularly around affordable housing, workforce development, and small business development, we also have a pretty strong economy that should be attractive to investors, he said. But that could also pose a challenge. Durham County is designated as Tier 3, which indicates that it is among the least distressed counties in North Carolina. State economic development initiatives place an emphasis on more distressed Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties. Wallace says tracts in all tiers have an equal shot at the designation. Urban poverty and rural poverty hurt just the same, he said. We do believe all communities are deserving of investment, or better yet, all communities are deserving of opportunity. Wallace says the agency will have an eye toward creation, economic expansion, and access to housing in making recommendations to Governor Cooper. Good candidates will also have a history of investment, or a desire for it, showing an ability to handle what could be a large influx of private dollars. Riley Carroll says additional resources like federal grants or local government subsidies will probably be needed to make sure these investments are effective. The tax bill doesn't explicitly empower local or state government to control how investments are made. So which census tracts are selected and who sets up the opportunity funds that serve them will be a key to the initiative's success. What happens when historically divested communities see a large influx of private investment activity? And what are the lessons learned that we've seen in major metros around gentrification and displacement? Riley Carroll asks. How can we be putting policies in place now that guard against that when we're choosing opportunity zones, we're ensuring that the investment that's coming is benefiting everyone in the community and is being done in an equitable manner? And now this week's feature article, The Hunted. Pedro Salmeron fled gangs in the most violent country on earth, only to be targeted by ICE and deported from North Carolina. We went to El Salvador to see what his life's like now. I'm a young person with a sort of old mind. Does that make sense in English? Pedro Salmeron says this in Spanish with an easy Salvadoran lilt, one that curls up at the ends of words into a quick tempo like a song. But he articulates most with his eyes. They are dark and round, widening underneath thick, straight eyebrows that frame his face. Despite a 5 o'clock shadow emerging as a patch on his chin, the 20-year-old barely looks like an adult, but he speaks in a mature cadence, deliberate and sincere, with a deep, calm voice like someone who has lived a thousand lives. "We'd say you have an old soul," I tell him. "Yes, exactly. And I don't know. I feel like I'm a little boring." He laughs, explaining how he passes the time watching Charlie Chaplin films and reading Greco-Roman myths. We're having this conversation in September outside of a supermarket in the province of San Miguel in El Salvador. The sun begins to set. A couple of boisterous men walk through the sliding doors into the store. On their way in, their laughter grows louder, even mischievous. They're a few yards away from us. One of them stares. Pedro looks over his shoulders at him. were sitting at a table by the doors next to an ice cream outpost. But he doesn't want to stick around for ice cream. The sky is getting darker. I should go home, he said. Pedro has been back in El Salvador for a year, but he doesn't leave his house much. It's too risky. The dangers that prompted him to leave for the United States at age 16 have only gotten worse. As Pedro puts it, the gangs are growing and cannot be contained. They are completely out of control. In November 2016, Pedro was deported from the Stewart Detention Center in Georgia, one of the harshest immigrant prisons in the country. Three inmates have died there in less than a year, according to immigration rights advocates. And it's there that he'd been detained for 9 months. Before that, he lived for 3 years in Charlotte with his family. His parents, who arrived more than 10 years ago, his American-born sister and an uncle. When Pedro was detained, his case became part of the so-called NC6, six Central American youths living in North Carolina who were rounded up by ICE in January of 2016. All of them said they had fled gang violence in their home countries. To date, two have been deported, including Pedro, both to El Salvador. Since these arrests, gut-wrenching stories of youths detained and families broken apart have mobilized communities into action, documenting the men and women fighting to stay here. But what happens to those immigrants plucked from American high schools and sent back to increasingly dangerous Central America? Alone. Pedro left behind a life he had just beginning to build, one hopeful, with opportunity despite his undocumented status. His parents remain in Charlotte, in a house they bought with money earned in construction and housekeeping. But soon, they'll face a difficult decision. Next year, the Trump administration will end the temporary protected status program for Salvadorans that kept Pedro's father in the country legally for a decade. Pedro's parents will have to decide whether to stay here illegally for the sake of their 10-year-old citizen daughter or pick up and leave for a native land now considered the murder capital of the world. The problem with being an immigrant is that you can't enjoy the same rights as everyone else, says Pedro, and unjust things happen to you. Despite all of that, so many people still live that way. The Salmorans were never disillusioned by the promise of the American dream. They just wanted a future free from danger, free from fear. For Pedro, there's no guarantee of that. There are currently 700,000 Salvadorians living in the United States. They left what is considered the deadliest country in the world outside of a war zone. But it isn't just a recent surge of gang violence that has mangled a society of just over 6 million people. Blood and poverty, corruption, and desperation are threads that link Salvadoran stories through generations. From 1980 to 1992, a civil war ravaged the small nation, claiming at least 75,000 lives. Amid increasing poverty, the leftist Fababondo Mati National Liberation Front fought the military-led government, which formed death squads in retaliation. By war's end, the United Nations Truth Commission found that more than 65% of the deaths, kidnappings, and torture were attributed to the Salvadoran government, which was backed by the United States. In the early 80s, President Reagan directed billions of dollars to El Salvador to fight communism. By 1990, despite the UN Agreement on Human Rights, signed that July, the government's American-trained paramilitaries, death squads, and army units had only gotten more vicious, massacring entire communities and wreaking havoc on a struggling nation. The war left behind a generation of trauma in a country that President Trump recently called a hellhole. Pedro's parents, Daniel and Carmen, who are in their 40s, remember the war well. Daniel says his brother was murdered by guerrillas who assumed that his close-shaven hair meant he was working with the government. Ironically, perhaps, his brother had hoped his clean-cut look would help him stay alive, because the military targeted anyone it deemed delinquent in appearance as a member of the PMLN. Daniel was able to flee shortly after his son's birth through TPS, a visa program implemented in 1990 for immigrants from countries that suffered long-term effects from natural disasters and violence. El Salvador was one of the first countries to reserve TPS due to its civil war and later earthquakes. TPS protects migrants from deportation and affords people like Daniel a work permit. But on January the 8th, the Trump administration announced that the program would soon end for the estimated 262,000 Salvadorans, TPS visa holders all in the United States. It's common for Salvadoran parents who arrived to survive the war and are still struggling to survive its aftermath to leave. Many Central Americans migrate north ahead of their kids and determine what to do for the families once they arrive in the States. Daniel and Carmen left Pedro, then a toddler, with his grandparents and aunt, hoping to earn enough money in the United States and maybe come back to a better El Salvador. My father felt what it was like to be at war, Pedro says, and from that war the gangs were created. Our economy was so low that instead of finding dignified work, because there wasn't any, it was easier for some people to just steal the very little that others had. Today, much of El Salvador is controlled by these gangs, mainly Barrio 18, or Calle 18, and Maria Shastrurka, or MS-13, both of which have their roots in Los Angeles. In 2016, the New York Times reported that gangs extort at least 70% of the country's businesses. Business owners could be killed on a whim if they didn't abide by the gang's demands. The Times story noted that a bus driver who owned a small transportation company was murdered over $21. The gangs also collude with the police and the government, which have turned a blind eye to much of the mayhem. The Wilson Center's Policy Forum estimates that 95% of the gang crimes reported in Central America go unpunished. Before he left for the United States at 16, Pedro reported a gang threat. Young men who knew him from school, possibly recent gang recruits, approached him on the walk home one afternoon. "Join us or we will kill you," they told him, a chilling but common refrain among Central American migrants. A few days later, Pedro's cousin's body had been found decapitated and castrated in a nearby town. The cousin, a carpenter, refused to give in to the extortion. He was murdered at night, his body discarded at a cul-de-sac so the neighbors would find him in the morning. "I had to leave immediately," Pedro says. He didn't even make it to his cousin's funeral. Carmen worried about him crossing the border alone at such a young age. It wasn't part of her plan. She and her husband wanted to bring their son in through a legal channel as a refugee. But after the cousin's murder, they knew it was time. The arrest of the NC6 led to a public campaign that resulted in the eventual release of four of the young men. Among them was Wilden David Gullion Acosta at Riverside High School, a student whose case sparked national interest. With his deportation ordered and a team of lawyers and activists fighting to stop it, Acosta, now 21, lives in limbo in Durham. According to the United Nations, an estimated 500,000 migrants cross Mexico's southern border each year. The majority comes from Central America's Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Each year, at least 20,000 of them vanish and presumably die on the journey to the United States. Pedro is among those who made it. In summer of 2014, President Obama ordered an emergent response at the border for what was labeled an unaccompanied minor crisis. The number of youths who entered the country had spiked from 16,000 in 2011 to more than 68,000 in 2014. Pedro was one of the more than 1,000 so-called unaccompanied minors who settled in Charlotte in 2014, This according to the Charlotte Observer. When he crossed into Texas in the summer of 2014, Pedro was detained for about a month, a normal procedure for Customs and Border Patrol. During the 2014 fiscal year, the Border Patrol apprehended 68,541 unaccompanied children at the U.S.-Mexican border. Many, like Pedro, were given a date to show up in court. Though despite looming deportation orders, ICE usually doesn't pursue unaccompanied minors until they turn 18. As soon as they were notified of his detainment, Pedro's parents found a lawyer to begin seeking asylum. But they soon learned that the migrants, like Pedro, don't have much of a chance in the American system. The criterion for asylum is to demonstrate a credible fear of persecution based on one's race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Despite the harrowing statistics about violence in Central America's Northern Triangle, judges rarely factor gang carnage into their decisions. Pedro's claim was, "And I'm scared to go back to El Salvador. I will get killed," says Bradley Blank, the last lawyer to represent Pedro. The merits of an asylum based on persecution from gang for a teenage made in El Salvador was very difficult, if not impossible. The current denial rate for Salvadorans seeking asylum in the U.S. is almost 83%, with Honduras about 80% and Guatemala about 77%, not far behind. In January of 2016, ICE Operation Border Guardian targeted anyone who had entered the country illegally after January of 2014, the very same youth deemed a humanitarian crisis less than 2 years earlier. Once the minors turned 18, ICE was ordered to place them in adult detention centers where they lost their unaccompanied minor status. According to ICE spokesman Brian Cox, the agency does not collect data based on age, so there's no telling how many 18 to 20-year-olds were detained in 2016. A person may have come in as a juvenile, says Cox, but as a legal adult, that comes into ICE's custody. That's irrelevant. In Operation Border Guardian was ramping up. Pedro was coming of age in Charlotte. Reunited with his parents and meeting his American-born sister for the first time, he felt a sense of relief he'd never had before. He joined his father, fellow Salvadorians, and new Mexican friends in playing music on the weekends. By the time he turned 18, Pedro knew how to play 9 instruments. By the end of 2015, rumors of ICE raids began circulating among the immigrant community. The Salmerons decided that school wasn't safe and pulled Pedro out of his classes. That didn't protect him. On January 26, 2016, ICE agents arrested Pedro. He was riding in a truck on the way to a construction job with his father and other workers. It was early in the morning, and his father says the car following them was white and unmarked. 4 men stepped out of the vehicle and recognized Pedro immediately. The agents said they had a warrant for Pedro's arrest. The Salmerons had long feared this would happen. They say Pedro's first lawyer had accepted a voluntary departure during the asylum application process without advising the family beforehand. The family hired a lawyer from the law office of Stephen Lastori, a firm based in Charlotte, and accuses the firm of malpractice. A lawyer from the firm told the Indy that it does not comment on its cases. When officials pulled Pedro out of the car, Daniel says an ICE agent spoke to him in Spanish. "Don't worry," he told me. "I'm a father too, and I'll make sure he's fine." But they made him sit there on the ground at the edge of the road. It had snowed the night before, so the ground was wet. It doesn't make any sense. "It's to humiliate them," Carmen says. Pedro remained quiet and polite, looking at his father and at the officers yanked zip ties around his thin wrists. "They were out hunting them," Carmen says. "They were being hunted." The courts referred to Pedro, a non-criminal, as a high-priority case, Benaya said. Basically, they were going to deport him no matter what. Manias handled Pedro's last case, a plea to get him out of the detention center. He also worked for Belmer Pohawk Juarez, another of the INC6 detained at Stewart. The boys' court hearings were scheduled back-to-back. Moraes filed habeas petitions for each, trying to prove that they were held in detention for an unlawful and unconstitutional amount of time. Benias argued that Pedro could not be deported in the foreseeable future because of his pending asylum case, which would require him to stay in the country. But then, during the September 16th court hearing in Columbus, Georgia, the prosecutor revealed a key clerical error. Benias had in his possession the official asylum interview notice mailed to the Salmeron family to prove that Pedro's asylum claim was indeed still pending. But the prosecutor stated that the computer system erred and sent out these notices. This mistake discredited Benias' argument, because asylum can only be granted to someone on U.S. soil. Benias thought that, with a pending application, he could get Pedro out of the detention and at least buy him some time. The public outcry for Pedro's release reached U.S. Representative Alma Adams, a Democrat whose district includes Charlotte. She wrote the director of ICA in March 2016 on Pedro's behalf and followed up her phone call that May. In August, she visited Pedro at Stewart and released the following statement. As a mother and as a former educator, Pedro's case is personal for me. No young person should be ripped away from their family and their community and thrown into a broken immigration system. Despite the Salmeron's appearances at rallies and on local television news, Pedro's case slipped from the public eye. As Myra Ortega of the Charlotte Legal Advocacy Center explains, he had already dropped out of school, so he didn't fit into the student narrative. His story just didn't become popular enough. Belmer, who lives in Greenville, was freed. Pedro didn't have the same luck. We basically gave the government a hard enough time that they gave in on that one, Benias said. We got Belmer out. They gave up on Belmer and doubled down on Pedro. While he was detained at Stewart, ICE agents dragged Pedro out of his cell on two separate occasions in the middle of the night and threw him into a van, leaving him to wait in the dark, thinking he was about to be deported, before returning him to his bunk an hour or so later. Pedro assumes that the first time was meant to be a form of psychological manipulation. Such reports out of Stewart are common, according to immigration advocates. The second time, though, while Pedro and other detainees were being transferred to a van, Benias said, the plans literally broke down, so they took the deportees back. The third time wasn't a joke or a mistake. Pedro was deported on a commercial airliner in November of 2016. The two ICE agents brought him a plane ticket, escorted him to the gate, and waited until it was time to board. He flew unaccompanied to El Salvador on a full flight of tourists and Salvadorans returning home from the States. Pedro wasn't allowed to call his mother or anyone in El Salvador before he left, and no one from ICE or Stewart notified the family of his deportation. But Carmen had missed a scheduled call from him that day and instinctively sent for her sister and parents to make the four-hour drive to San Salvador to pick him up. From her kitchen table in Charlotte, she arranged for everything. Her family was there within 45 minutes of his arrival. They met him at the cafe outside of the exit door. The drive from San Salvador to Pedro's village starts at 3:30 a.m. on a humid day in late September. As the sun begins to rise, our truck jolts. The driver hits the brakes to avoid a cluster of rust-colored cows lazily crossing the highway. The road cuts through a jungle of banana trees that become a string of little towns bustling with morning foot traffic. Women carry baskets of masa on their heads, walking carefully through the streets and darting into storefronts where they pound dough into pupusas. As we drive into the villages, I notice something jarringly familiar. The mustard yellow and blood-red Wells Fargo logo jutting out of a worn building, spruced up by fresh turquoise paint. The only modern sign among hand-pointed calligraphy signals an ATM, where people can pull out their remittances from the U.S. in cash. According to the International Organization of Migration, 17-18% of El Salvador gross GDP comes from remittances. Of that, 30% come from people holding TPS in the United States. The farther we drive, the more worried my driver becomes. He starts making calls to his family. "My brother-in-law is from here," he says. "It's pretty bad." I asked which gang was in charge. He said he's not sure, but in the last few months, youths have been increasingly come under threat. The highway crosses the Lampa River, one of Central America's largest rivers, which also serves as a part of the border with Honduras. "The border is a fount of trafficking," says Salvadoran journalist Luis Quintala. "Gangs contraband," she explains. "The young population is especially vulnerable. There's nothing to do. No sports leagues, no community activities to center all the youth spread out in the villages." She recalls a recent news story in which a schoolteacher tried to warn his students to stay out of trouble. Gangsters came into his classroom during the school day and murdered him in front of the class just hours after killing his daughter. Quintanilla says poverty perpetuates the cycle of violence. It's super cliché, but the gang becomes a support system, especially financially, that we can't otherwise create within communities, she said. And the same parents worried for their children are sending them across the border as a result. We arrive at a town near Pedro's home in the middle of a holiday procession. Students are dressed in military green and crisp hats, some practicing an armed salute and holding rifles across their chests, while others form a drum line. Cell phone service is shaky out in the country, so we inquire at the mayor's office of the family's whereabouts. A secretary recognizes Pedro's name. She flips through a large tome of handwritten birth records from the 1990s, finding him within a couple of minutes. We are escorted into a small shopping center and up a narrow flight of stairs where a woman selling pupusas from a takeout window becomes our accidental fixer. She insists on calling her nephew, who drives a motor taxi, to safely get us to Page's remote village. For a half hour, we ride through foot traffic and police caravans, and to the sound of cadets banging on the drum line become a faint thump in the distance. We putter through a forest of banana trees, its slick foliage darkening our rocky path. We arrive at the Salmeron's home, which is high on a hill, and find the doors wide open, leading to a living room painted in sherbet hues of orange and pink. Pedro's childhood portraits are featured in giant-sized lacquered prints that hang high, almost touching the ceiling. Pedro's grandmother points to a neighbor's house a few yards away, just past the tall coconut trees that flank their hammocks. A couple of months earlier, she said, police raided it and arrested two young men, kids she's known all her lives, for being involved in gangs. Danger is ever present here. A recent report by Amnesty International pegs the murder rate in El Salvador as 108 per 100,000 inhabitants. For comparison, the murder rate in the United States was 5.3 per 100,000 inhabitants. The report says that the spike in immigration and asylum claims is directly connected to this violence. It also lays out statistics from a survey of 747 Salvadoran adults who had migrated abroad and were being deported back. 42% said they were fleeing threats, crime, danger, and extortion. 23% said they were seeking a better economic status. Those two factors, poverty and violence, are often connected. In 2016, the World Bank reported that while economic growth in El Salvador reached 2.4%, the country remained the slowest-growing economy of Central America. "El Salvador is a country that offers absolutely nothing," says Pedro. "For someone who studies or was born in the United States, it would be difficult to live in a country like El Salvador. The economy is very low. it's very difficult to find an adequate job. Compounding matters, because he turned 18 in the States, Pedro lacks proper identification in El Salvador, while people obtain a new ID card after becoming adults. That ID is needed to obtain a work permit. He is, in a sense, undocumented in his homeland, too. Just like he was scared to go to school in Charlotte, Pedro fears going to school in El Salvador. He goes once a week to turn in his homework, lamenting that this is the third time he's repeated the 10th grade. He worries about finding work. El Salvador simply isn't equipped to manage the increasing number of deportees or retornados like Pedro, especially in rural areas. San Salvador is more blatantly sullied by gang violence, but community and professional organizations offer support and jobs for the deported, such as call center gigs for English speakers. But while Pedro risked the journey to the U.S. alone, his parents were on the other side waiting for him. To move to El Salvador would mean he'd completely be on his own. Many Salvadoran children are left fending for themselves while their parents migrate or work jobs away from home to barely make ends meet. And without parents or vocational options to climb out of poverty, some kids join gangs willfully. A young guy may say, "I can get used to this, and I'll be taken care of here," says Daniel. And once they're in, they can't leave. If they do, they leave dead or end up in prison. The Salmorans are subsistence farmers, living off the milk and cheese products their dairy cows produce. Pedro slipped back into his old lifestyle after returning to El Salvador, helping his family while he figured out how to get more viable work. But about a month after he returned, Pedro said, he was taking the family cows out to a pasture about a kilometer from home. Four men wearing masks ran up to him. They said they knew him, though Pedro did not recognize their voices. They gave him an ultimatum, the same one that prompted him to flee in 2014. "Join us or die." "They said they knew I was in America and assumed I had money," he recalls. Pedro ran home as quickly as he could. He filed a police report, but he hasn't heard anything about his case since. The Salmorans and thousands of similarly situated families, mixed immigration status, separated, are caught in the limbo of a legal system that often feels arbitrary and feeds on income inequality. This is a system set up by and administered by human beings, says Maureen Abel, a staff attorney at the Immigration Justice Project, a program of the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy. "This means all of our human failings are going to seep into it. It's inevitable. Unless we have institutional safeguards against it, it's going to happen." According to the American Immigration Council, just 37% of immigrants facing removal and 14% of immigrants in detention secure representation. And though undocumented immigrants are being imprisoned, immigration is a civil matter, not a criminal one, meaning detainees have no Sixth Amendment right to an attorney. Even if they did, it's often cost prohibitive for immigrants who work low-paying jobs without legal status. Daniel Salmoron works 6 days a week as a construction worker. Carmen works the same amount of time for far less money as a domestic worker. She says they spend $2,800 on the first lawyer and about $5,000 on Brad Benaeus. And the costs and the physical risks who won't deter Central American immigrants from trying to cross the border, Abel said. People get to this stage fleeing for their lives because they are confused or don't have the money to go through the process or because they are afraid that they will lose, Abel said. They legitimately believe they will die going home, so they prioritize being alive over going through the legal status. "These are brave people," Quintela said, "and there's nothing in El Salvador pushing them to stay." Even a year after Pedro's deportation, Benaeus remains tenacious on his behalf. Earlier this month, he filed a last-ditch appeal arguing that because Pedro's unaccompanied minor status wasn't suspiciously revoked on paper by another agency, as legal required, upon his detainment as an adult, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service is instructed to assume he's still an unaccompanied minor and not look beyond the issue. That, he said, would have gotten him that asylum hearing that he was scheduled to have. If Inez's argument prevails, Pedro's case would set a precedent. And if Pedro was granted an asylum hearing, Bonilla said, they would legally require him to return to the U.S. where he could live a normal life while the asylum process plays out, perhaps over 2 or 3 years. If the best I can do is to create chaos and get them to answer these questions, I'm going to do that, says Bonilla. I think in front of a judge, the right judge, it's a strong argument. We've been fighting for Pedro for so long. This is it. There's no other avenue. Anytime you have an argument that hasn't been heard in any other part of the country, you've got a shot. Every Sunday for the 9 months Pedro was at Stewart, and the Salmerons traveled 7 hours round-trip to see him for an hour. Through these visits, Carmen watched 40 pounds dwindle from his son's already thin frame. That malnourished image is etched into her memory. Her one consolation these days is seeing Pedro through video chats, his face plumper, well-fed by her own mother. He sometimes calls her on the rare occasions when he leaves his house. I'm going shopping, Mama. Want to tag along? It's the only way we can still feel close, Carmen says. It's like I'm walking through the streets with him. I get to see the mountains. The family will face tough choices in the coming months. They're not sure what to do. As with most migrants, their lives have been transient and unpredictable. But now there's a deadline. They have less than 18 months before Daniel's TPS visa expires. The truth is, here we have a lot, but in El Salvador, we have Pedro, Carmen says, smiling through tears. We can't take away our daughter's future. We would do anything for her. Some 3,000 miles away from his home family in Charlotte, Pedro says his only choice is to remain hopeful, to look at what's in front of him and not get wrapped up in long-term goals. Life without papers in the United States isn't easy. But my life was relatively good, he said. Here I'm missing so many things. It's like I'm back in my infancy. His immediate plans is to finally graduate from high school. His dream is to play music for a living, and he says that lifestyle won't earn him much respect in El Salvador. He likes drawing and computers. If he can afford it, maybe he'll go to school for graphic design. Collectively, the family has survived a brutal civil war and crushing poverty in El Salvador and imprisonment in the U.S. In both of their homes, they've lived with uncertainty, fearful that anything they've earned can be taken away. The day I visited in September, Pedro's grandmother set a pot of beans on the kitchen table, waiting for Pedro to come back from an appointment, part of his effort to obtain a work permit. The family's dairy profits have diminished since gangs took over the area. But fresh cheese and homemade tortillas serve as beautiful remnants of what is still possible in a country with deep scars. She walked out to the black back porch to water a pot of herbs, her silhouette framed by the green hills and bright blue sky. Unprompted, she told me that Pedro is fighting simply to get ahead. Freedom is what he doesn't have, she asked. He just has bad luck. And now from the indie food section, First Draft. Bière de Femme celebrates North Carolina's pioneering women brewmasters at Raleigh Beer Garden. If someone were to walk into a brew house in North Carolina 150 years ago, it would most likely be an actual house, and the brewmaster would be women. The women in brewing has something of a hidden history. But at the second annual Bière de Femme All-Women Beer Festival on Saturday at the Raleigh Beer Garden, it's going to be difficult to ignore women's contributions. On several mornings throughout January and February, female and non-binary teams took over the North Carolina breweries where they worked to prep for the Bière de Femme. The teams, including brewers, bartenders, managers, marketers, and lab tech staff, brewed a variety of styles, from a spicy Vienna lager to a tart peach grisette. The first Bière de Femme, and first all-brewer festival of its kind, took place last March in Shelby, North Carolina. 2 months later, the first Femme Ale Brew Fest was held in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And more are in the works all over the country. Bière de Femme is put on by the NC chapter of the Pink Boot Society, an Oregon-based nonprofit that supports women in the brewing industry. Proceeds go towards scholarships for women in the field. On the morning of Friday, January 26th, the women of Mystery Brewing Company in Hillsboro got together to brew beer, not unlike any other day in the predominantly woman-run brew house. Four female brewers work at Mystery on a regular basis, which makes the brewery an outlier of an industry where only 4% of the brewmasters are women. The truck drivers are kind of funny because they walk in and always suspect a bearded dude and find women, says Amanda Lee Sherrill, packaging manager at Mystery. We say that the owner, Eric Myers, probably has an honorary uterus because he's a much more sensitive owner. For the festival, Mystery's house maintain manager Brittany Jude came up with the idea to brew a golden ale with cinnamon that's meant to be reminiscent of chevaux, or which they plan to serve alongside a chocolate dessert. They named their beer Domestic Goddess, partially inspired by Nigella Lawson's feminist baking book, and partly because a few members of their brew team are serious bakers. One of the brewmasters commented, "I think there are a lot of people who think that you have to have a giant bushy beard to brew beer, and an event like this is an awesome opportunity to prove that that's not the case. There's going to be some dang tasty beer at this thing, and it's all brewed by women." In case you're interested, the date is Saturday, March 3rd at 2 p.m., the Bière de Femme Festival, 614 Glenwood Avenue, Raleigh. The cost will be $45 to $75. The VIP tickets are $75. The gate will open at 2 p.m. for general admission. That's the $45. Guests will receive commemorative glass and beer samples from all the participating breweries. VIP guests will have an additional hour to sample with a dedicated VIP area, special bottle pours, and light appetizers. Well, that's about it for another week. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.